History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to take a little initiative and ask a few questions and then take the time to patiently listen as memories, sometimes that are buried for decades, start to come to the forefront again. The idea here is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price has been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. If it sounds a little different this week, it's because I'm outdoors. I had the privilege of visiting the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., where more than 4,000 gold stars represent the well over 400,000 Americans who died while serving in World War II. The rest of this breathtaking memorial honoring the over 16 million Americans in uniform during the war. The memorial held a ceremony on Friday, June 3rd, to commemorate the 80th anniversary of the Battle of Midway, including the reading of over 350 names, men who died in that pivotal Pacific battle. When it comes to the European theater, it's hard to think of any day more tide-turning, any day more crucial than the longest day, D-Day, June 6, 1944. And as the 78th anniversary of the invasion of Normandy comes around this week, 30 World War II vets are in Normandy with our friends from the Best Defense Foundation, including a few of the veterans you've gotten to meet on Hometown Heroes. The reality is, this will be one of the last D-Day anniversaries while we still have these veterans with us, and for them to have a spectacular send-off from Delta Airlines in Atlanta and a historic first-ever commercial flight landing in Normandy was definitely special. But what it points back to is what they don't want us to forget. Here's what Army veteran Robert Boots Schwinard had to say to the cheering crowd in France that welcomed these American vets.
We have something in common. We were victorious. Thank goodness. So here we are, 78 years later. We made it health-wise. We made it through battles, and we're here. And we're very happy and appreciative. Appreciative of you and of this greeting and what's being done for us as veterans. I think this is it's perfect. It's great, and I'm so pleased. And I just wanted to have a chance to say something for the veterans because we all feel the same. Thank you.
These 30 vets, including three who you've met on Hometown Heroes who are all over 100 years old, will be visiting all the key sites this week, including three special stops on June 6th for the 78th anniversary. One of the vets on that trip has one of the more memorable D-Day stories we've heard, especially how things started out for 101st Airborne Paratrooper Tom Rice. He was 22 years old at the time. Here's what he told me when I asked if he had heard any rumors or rumblings before June 6th, 1944, about what was about to happen.
No.
It came out of the blue.
That was secret. We knew we're going to go to Europe, but that's all. We don't know where we're going to land. We know how we're going to get there, but where we're going to land, who's going to be with us, whether it's going to be British or going to be a Polish group or French or whatever it may be. We got radio communication from Axa Sally quite a few times, and she said, "We know you, the 501st Parachute Infantry, has just landed in England. We have 2,000 white crosses, not with your names on them, and you could use those crosses as stepping stones to get to the ground, and you won't need your parachutes because we're waiting for you."
Wow, that's encouraging.
Yeah, it was. So we gave her the raspberry, and she played good music after that, you know, all the Glenn Miller stuff. A few things happened like that. So
I know that June 6th is a very special day in your life, one of, I'm sure, a lot of mixed emotions, and we're going to talk later about what you do every year on that date, but probably the most accurate label attached to that day in 1944 is the longest day. And I imagine it started earlier for you than most.
Oh, yeah, about 4 to 5 hours earlier. I believe our takeoff time was 10:21 English double summer time.
On June 5th?
Yeah, They would be taking off at different times, forming a wedge of 45 aircraft. Now, this mass armada is going to be 10 miles long. It's going to be at least 2 miles wide. The pathfinders are going to take, I believe, 57 minutes to get to their drop zones. The paratroopers are coming in at 60-some minutes. And then the next morning, gliders in 76 minutes. I think it's just about a kind of a guesswork on that schedule. So we had trained hard. We were isolated. No contact with anybody on the outside. Some of the guys had English girlfriends. Could not make contact with them. No connection with the civilian population whatsoever. There was guards all around this assembly area. On the evening of June 5, we met early evening, and we went to our aircraft. We had six parapacks slung underneath the aircraft. Each one weighed 300 pounds and had all of our equipment, probably machine gun, tripod, and ammunition, and maybe a bundle full of K-rations or TNT or whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. Six parapacks underneath. Each one weighed 300 pounds. We rolled those, packed them, and rolled them, and attached them to the aircraft, and then practiced a drop so that things going to work.
So you load onto this
C-47? The C-47
DC-3. Mm-hmm.
And, I jumped number one, last one to get in the plane, so I was number one seat there. It's the shape of an arrow, and we were parked on the side, what do we call part of that arrow. Each plane would swing down and then take off. If any plane had a problem, there would be a mess.
Yeah.
Planes were taking off, one right after another, one every 10 seconds. I mean, when that plane revved up, it sounded like every rivet was going to come apart, you know. I mean, there was noise. I went forward, sat down on the lower deck, and leaned against the cockpit door and told the pilot that if there's any problem that relates to us, let me know. I'll fall back and wake up. So I stayed in that position most of the time until the officer in charge, Lieutenant Jansen, told me to get up there to number one. You know, above the door, there's three lights.
Mm-hmm.
There's a red, a white, and a green one. The pathfinders are already in. Some of them missed the drop zone. Some of them didn't. Some of them were spread so far apart that it's unbelievable. We got the worst drop in the entire 13,200.
Out of the whole D-Day operation.
On the whole D-Day operation, yeah.
Why? What happened? Where were you dropped?
When we took off at 10:41, English double summertime, we flew at 5,000 feet. We assembled in groups of 45 each. That was called a section.
Mm-hmm.
I was in section 14, third from the lead plane on the right. I'm jumping number one. We dropped down to 1,500 feet after the section had organized itself. Now, we were about 100 feet wingtip to wingtip, real close, tight formation. We flew past Jersey and Guernsey Island. In the water was a small submarine that emitted a signal to show that we were on the right track for the pilots to follow. And then we got to another signal beyond Jersey and Guernsey Island, and that point we turned left. Now, if you can visualize the Cottonton Peninsula on the left and the Brittany Peninsula on the right, this was a neat scheme because the Germans didn't know whether we're going to go right or we're going to go left.
Mm-hmm.
So we turned left. I'm at the door getting things organized and following instructions. I looked out and I saw low tide. I saw the community of Brownsville, and I could see the pattern of rivers that ran into the channel there. White light is on. Red and green are off.
Mm-hmm.
When we hit Brownsville, the red light goes on, means we got 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody was stand up and hook up. We're all standing up. We're holding on to the steel cable that runs, 3/8 inch steel cable that runs right through the center. Mm-hmm. We have to hook up our webbing to that with an anchor line snap fastener in our left hand and make sure it faces the right way. Got it faced the wrong way, could be in trouble. So stand up and hook up. It was verbal signals and mechanical signals so that everybody understood. A red light was on. We were checking. We ran into fog. Now we're less than 100 feet apart.
Mm-hmm.
The lead plane had a blue light on the dome. and it was at a little lower altitude. The others were staggered up a little bit so the pilots could see the blue light. When that blue light goes on, that means that they got that lead plane got the signal from the Pathfinders, and they crossed the T, and they snapped on the green light. Everybody snaps their green lights on. So we jump at that point. Ran into fog. I was looking out the door, and I could see just almost a rectangular area that was just filled with tracers. There were yellow, there were red, there were green, and white. It looked like the 4th of July, you know. Nothing bursting like that, but tracers coming up. This is what we're going to have to go through.
The artillery fire is already happening.
It's already happening. We're going to have to go through this. Mm-hmm. So they avoided it, and I think the pilot may have panicked a little here, because there was an investigation afterwards. We swung off to the right. All of Company C swung off to the right because we had 9 planes. Mm-hmm. Our company commander ended 20 miles from our drop zone. We didn't get together for a whole week. We were spread all over the place. We were originally, as I understood it, to jump on drop zone B. They found out that drop zone B was underwater. So it was fortunate that when they broke the pattern of flight, we were over the edge of D, and I went out over the edge of D. The only thing that bothered me is that I was going to get castrated because the machine gun bullets were on the left wing, and they might come through the floor of the plane. You know. Mm.
So as you're jumping, your plane's getting hit.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. You could hear it on the wing.
Wow.
And now our gas tanks are not self-sealing. And the pilot is yawing and pitching. We're going up and down to avoid penetration with shells, you know, mm-hmm. and bullets, whatnot. Up and down. The guys were wobbling. The green light goes on. I jump. And just as I did, number one and number two men pull the switches. The plane goes up because the load was dropped.
Right.
And I went out the door at the same time. And when I turned, the prop blast, we were going 165 miles an hour. Mm-hmm. We got a jump at 95 to 100. The jump master, lieutenant, called the pilot and said, slow the thing down. We can't jump. Now, the pilot's yawing and pitching, whatnot. Mm-hmm. He ignored it. So when I went out, we were yawing and pitching, and the plane went up 50 feet. The parapets dropped. The prop blast hit me and threw me up against the side of the aircraft.
Wow.
My left arm got caught in the lower left-hand corner of the door. So I swung out, my helmet came down over my face, my reserve parachute was forced up to my face because the musette bag was underneath. So I didn't know what the dickens was going on. 2.8 seconds transpired, and that thing should have opened by that time. So I swung in and hit the aircraft side again, swung out, got the helmet up, and I saw the parapax cover of the parachute flapping under the rudder of the airplane. So number two and number three man got loose, got out. Mm-hmm. So when I swung back in, I turned a little bit and I got free.
I can't imagine what that feels like. You talk about disaster here. This is your moment, your first experience in the war, really, in what's going to be a combat situation. You almost didn't get away from the plane.
Get away from it, yeah.
And you would have died.
Yeah.
So if you couldn't free yourself, probably.
I had a Hamilton wristwatch, a gold Hamilton wristwatch. It cost me $150, and that was stripped right off of my arm. My arm was black and blue from the armpit down to the wrist.
Ooh.
And I didn't know it until 3 weeks later and taking some clothes off. We didn't take any clothes off, you know. I have to guess at the altitude. I'll make a conservative guess. I jumped from 500 feet to 400 feet. 750.
Uh-huh.
So I was on the ground pronto.
That must have been a pretty rough landing.
Oh, yeah. It was a hard landing.
So what'd you come down in? What kind of terrain?
It was grassy area that was more pasture than anything, and then a small ditch that was, about 6 feet deep, full of water, smelly, dirty water. And so here I am on my back. I can't get my harness off because the musette bag, the reserve parachute, a May West, and a quick release. Now, the quick release had a toadstool type thing on it, and when you arm it, a red dot shows, and then you hit it like that, and it springs out.
Mm-hmm.
You probably know about that thing.
Right.
Okay, whatever they want to call it. I couldn't get at that thing. I had a double zipper up here under my chin with a switchblade knife. So I unzipped that. And incidentally, I had the Cricket under there. The Cricket fell out. I lost it and didn't know it. I got the double-bladed knife out and started cutting the risers. I got halfway through one riser, and number two and three man came up. They had the mortar. Evidently, they had found one of the bundles and got the mortar. So we crossed the canal, and Frank Ficarota, one of the guys on the carrying the mortar parts, went into the canal. We had to dig him out. He came out smelling like you can't believe, yelling and screaming. This is supposed to be a quiet situation, you know.
So, yeah, it's dark. Yeah, it's the middle of the night. Dark. You're supposed to be surprising the enemy.
So we got him quiet, and we worked our way over to a decomposed granite road. I heard some footsteps maybe 150 yards away on decomposed granite. So I got him quiet, did the click. One of the guys did the click, because mine was lost. And they got a click back.
And that's what, when you mentioned the Cricket earlier, some people are saying, what, he's carrying little bugs around? No, this was a device that would allow you to communicate with others without drawing too much attention.
That's right, and no identification. See.
What does it sound like?
Click, click, like that. You just didn't hold one click, you were going click, click.
Right.
And the answer would be double click, 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 click. Then we would work toward each other, clicking continually.
Right.
We got within safe distance. Then we'd use the password. So let's say you're in the airborne and you're one of my friends, and we clicked successfully. I'm not sure about you. It could be a German enemy that has one of these things.
Yeah.
So I go with the password, flash.
Gordon.
You would then recognize that flash. Uh-huh. Possibly I'm an American.
Right.
I don't know still about you. You come back with thunder. Then that puts me at ease that you possibly are an American. Now, to cinch it from flash, thunder, then I'd say welcome. And a German trying to pronounce welcome, the W is a V, welcome, you see. You'd pick that up real quick. Then we'd meet, get up and hug each other and find out who we are, and he's probably somebody from the 82nd Airborne.
And you're doing all this, which you've never done before, not in this situation, in the dark, with an arm that almost got ripped off, a back that's probably all bruised up from the impact.
Yeah.
Were you feeling pain? Were you even conscious of that?
No. I mean, our focus was to do what we're supposed to do and get organized and group. Because we got objectives.
And did you have any idea where you were?
No.
Are you imagining yourself in his shoes yet? Well, there's much more to come. And right now, 100-year-old Tom Rice is in Normandy with the Best Defense Foundation. If you're not following that nonprofit organization on social media, now would be the perfect time to check them out. It's time for our first break, but this special edition of Hometown Heroes, marking the 78th anniversary of D-Day and the invasion of Normandy, will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special D-Day edition of the program. 78 years now since Allied forces swarmed into occupied Europe to turn the tide. A heavy, heavy price was paid, as we know, and we discussed that last week with Memorial Day. Right now in France, a group of 30 American veterans is getting the kind of tribute that fits the collective sacrifice the Allies contributed all those years ago. Everywhere these veterans go with the Best Defense Foundation, a hero's welcome is waiting. There are a couple female veterans we've had the absolute pleasure of meeting here on Hometown Heroes. Dorothy Jones from the Navy, Betty Rosevere from the Army. They're both 101 years old and have been wowing French crowds all weekend. It's always meaningful when paratrooper Tom Rice is there. At age 100, this may be his final trip to Normandy. A recent mishap foiled his plans to recreate his D-Day parachute jump on the anniversary, but we left off with Tom behind enemy lines 78 years ago on June 6, 1944, and he told us he had no idea where he was.
These guys were coming down the road. It must have been 8 or 10 of them coming down the road, and we clicked them and met them, and we stood up and kind of conversed, and one of them came to me and said, "I've got a hand grenade with the pin pulled. You cannot put the pin back in a hand grenade. It's not possible because the bend is bent."
Right.
And he probably didn't have the pin anyway. So here he is with a hand grenade, squeezing it like almighty, and if you ever let loose of it, that spoon goes up. You know what the hand grenade is like.
Yeah.
And it fires the cap, and it goes down the train of powder, and then 5 seconds it goes. Oh, he said, "I got a hand grenade with a pin pull." I said, "Okay, give it to me." Had everybody get down. I got down and rolled over to the ditch, dropped it in the ditch, rolled back, and by the time I got to the middle of the road, the thing exploded, and I'm covered with water. So we went on down the road a little further. No enemy. What is this, the game we're playing here?
Hold on a second. Why did you want the hand grenade? Why did you put yourself in greater danger?
Because I was responsible for those guys, and I just took it on myself. I was a ranking guy there, even mm-hmm. though I may not have been. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, I found out who the guy was that had a hand grenade, and he was a lieutenant, and I'm just a staff sergeant.
But your leadership qualities,
there you go,
rose to the occasion.
Yeah, right. I had to.
Yeah. So. Right, sorry for interrupting. I'm sure a lot of people are saying, "Wait, if that guy—that's his problem. That's not your problem."
So we broke up into groups and went on down the road. I'm saying to these guys, "Nothing's happening here," but I saw a house on the side of the road, about 50 yards back, and I said, "We got to investigate this." So I set about 5 of them around to the back of the house. And Floyd Martin and me and another guy went to the front of the house. I said to Floyd Martin, "Don't bang on the door like an ugly American. Just knock, you know." He banged on it with his rifle, but you could hear it from probably 2 kilometers away. And after about 30 seconds or so, a Frenchman came to the door. Blasé as could be, you wouldn't believe this, in a long white nightgown from shoulder to floor. Mm-hmm. With a white tousled nightcap.
Wow.
With a dish with a candle in it lighted. Now, if you were in that situation, what would you think or say or do?
That's a good question. What'd you do?
I started to laugh.
I think I probably would have laughed.
I started to laugh like you can't believe. He didn't respond to anything, so I just pushed him aside and went in. 3 or 4 of the guys followed that were behind me, and I unloaded the map and put it on the floor and tried to get him to tell us where we were. He finally saw the word Carentan, and he pointed in that direction. His wife came out, dressed the same way. Uh-huh. That was no laugh. I didn't laugh at that one. After trying to talking with him and not frightening him, he said he'll want to be excused for a minute. So we did okay. So he went out, and he got 6 rounds of ammunition. He gave us 4, and he kept 2. And so we left right away, assured him we're not going to do anything. Went out on the road again with 3 of us, walking in the ditch real low, and a lieutenant ahead of me yelled, "Hey, Sergeant, come here." Now, he was standing at a large gate where cattle would go in and come out, and it was a pasture field in there. He was standing there and said, "Sergeant, I want you to walk around this field on the edge. I'm going to stay right here and wait." He had a carbine rifle, a short one, with a metal stock on it. This guy was bound to, had it in his mind, he's going to get a sniper. I'm a bait.
Thanks a lot.
I knew it was exactly what he's doing, so I walked that perimeter 600 and some yards, and I had my trigger finger ready to go, and I had that submachine gun up, you know, looking into the trees. Mm-hmm. I got back to the point where he set me off. He was gone. I learned a couple things. Never arrive at your point of departure as a final destination, because they could have seen it, uh-huh. could have watched me. 50-some years later, New York staff writer called wanting to come out and interview me.
Uh-huh.
He took 100 pictures of me for all what reason, I don't know. Then he started asking questions. And on the question period, he asked me to explain some heroism. I said they were all heroes. And then it hit me. I'll explain what happened right there. And I told him what happened, what that lieutenant did. I said, this is a situation of cowardice. They printed that story. They printed my picture with it. And I hope that son of a gun saw it.
If he made it through the war.
If he made it, yeah. If he made it. I figured this guy's going to get somebody killed. But so we wandered around there, out in fields, and a horse was had been hit with shrapnel. A medic I had with me, Robert Schill, he patched him up with sulfadiazone, and we used the horse as a protection to get to some other point. Went into a house, searching the houses, and I crossed a window, and I had a rifle shot come through for the sniper. It hit just in front of me and caught me in the leg. It was a hard, like I was hit like a baseball bat almost, you know. So mm-hmm. I could pull the pant leg up and pulled it out and put it in my pocket. I never know what happened to it after that.
So this is your first day.
Yeah.
And you're already hit.
First day. This is June 6th.
Mm-hmm. And you've already got a wound in your leg.
Yeah, I got a wound that I didn't pay too much attention to. It didn't bother me that much, crying out loud. I'm not going to a medic and say, give me a Purple Heart or make a record of this baloney.
Mm-hmm.
But I've known lieutenants who've done that.
Sure.
But we began to hook up with some of the guys. And on the road, we found maybe 15 or 20 of them. Major Allen was there. He organized us into a small group, put our packs down, drop our packs, don't take anything else with you except your ammunition. We're heading toward La Barquette Lock. Now, the set of locks there. And the Germans closed the locks to flood the entire area.
Right.
The locks were closed. We were going to open them. Now, by the time the locks were opened and the water flowed out and drained into the English Channel, the battle would have been miles beyond it. So I figured, this is a phony, crazy, stupid objective. But we went down there, and we ran into the 6th German Parachute Infantry Regiment. They were 3,000 in strength. The battalions were in two or three different places. One was in Perrier, and they were having a good time. They were having a party. And a messenger came in and said, they're coming, they're coming. The aircraft were coming in. They weren't bombarding yet, but he heard all these aircraft coming, and the parachutes are dropping. In the British zone, they dropped dummy parachutes with explosives on them. So when they hit the ground, the explosive went to attract all the Germans over there. So things were pumping on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So Colonel Heidi, who was the commanding officer there, he got these guys organized. One battalion was to go to the beach.
And we're talking about the German forces.
Yeah.
Colonel Heidi was with the German forces.
See, they were 300 feet above us.
Uh-huh. And you said 3,000 strong. How many do you think were with you?
It was 50.
3,000 versus 50?
50. Well, not quite yet. They were broken into three battalions.
Okay.
And the battalion, one battalion was to go to the beachhead and to get in between us and the landing forces to disrupt that landing.
Right.
We met them at a place called Pinamy. Their second battalion evidently was a little bit north, but near the beach. They were coming south. Rifles slung on their shoulder. Did you see Saving Private Ryan?
Sure.
You remember these guys taken out with that captain looking for Private Ryan, smoking cigarettes and rifles slung?
Yeah.
These Germans were singing their national anthem and whatnot. Going toward Carentan, another battalion was in another opposite direction, some distance from them, going to W4, which was a blockhouse. They had Goliaths there with 200 pounds of dynamite on little automatic wheelbarrow kind of thing. And they would control them by radio, and they wanted to get those things in there to blow up any of the American forces that were coming in.
Mm-hmm.
But when the guys did come in, W4 had been knocked out, and these crazy little machines were running around. The guys would go up to them, put hand grenades on them, and then back off. And that's what but anyway, we got into a big battle with maybe 400 Germans.
And this is, now we're hearing why you said earlier that you had the worst possible drop.
Yeah.
So there's 50 of you, there's 400 Germans.
400 Germans.
And it's still dark?
It's light.
The sun has come up. It's the morning of June 6th.
Yeah.
And what do you have personally to use against the enemy?
my Thompson submachine gun.
Uh-huh.
But on the way down to La Barquette Lock, three of us were ordered to go to the lock and outpost it. So I didn't get to Penemy, which was maybe 300 yards from me. I was at La Barquette Lock. So we outposted it that night. We figured some of the Germans in Carentan are going to come down on patrols, mm-hmm. whatnot. 400 of them are in battle with 50 Americans. We captured them all.
Wow.
Amazing. Captured them all. So we set up that night because I figured certainly there's going to be some Germans coming down and finally trying to find out what's going on. I set up about six stakes. I set wire between the stakes. We hung wire from the stakes vertically and tied tin cans on them. In the tin cans, I put bolts and nuts and all kinds of things. I mean, it's a silly thing, but it's kind of creative there.
Mm-hmm.
So any patrol coming through has to come down that way. And he's not going to be able to see that because it's so dark and the metal is dark and it's kind of low. He's going to trip on it. 2 o'clock in the morning, patrol came through. I was situated right in the corner. The orchard is long leg and the short leg. I was right in the corner of the short leg. The other two guys are on the long leg. And we were tied together wrist to wrist with parachute suspension line. If any noise or anything you hear comes through there, or you're alerted for some reason. We stayed 2 hours on and then slept. We alternated that. Just jerked those cords, and we just start shooting out there. German patrol came through. We got one of them. He might have been his only man. I'm not sure. Can't prove it. But he was out there, and he moaned all night long. One of the guys had experience as working in a mortuary, so he took his trench knife and went out there and finished him off. And so we pulled him in the morning. We dug a trench for him in the orchard, and we cut some limbs off the tree and made a cross out of it. I still have his parachute wings, cloth wings. I hid them on my shoe, so if I ever captured with those things, boy, I'd be in real trouble. And none of us got hit.
None of them were hit there, but Tom Rice would be wounded later during the Battle of the Bulge. He is one of 30 veterans in Normandy this week with the Best Defense Foundation. And if those kind of battlefield return missions touch your heart, perhaps that's a cause you'd like to support. You can follow the Best Defense Foundation on social media, and I have relevant links posted for you at hometownheroesradio.com. It's time for our final break, but we'll hear more of this amazing 100-year-old D-Day paratrooper's story when we come back. We'll also hear what General Dwight Eisenhower and President Franklin D. Roosevelt had to say 78 years ago when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
I always love hearing from listeners, and so many of you tell me you listen to Hometown Heroes while you're on the road. Nobody spends more time on the road than our friends in the trucking business. And if that's your business, I'm sure you know about Central Valley Trailer Repair. If you don't, you really should. Conveniently located near California's major transportation arteries, CVTR has stockpiles of parts waiting for you in Fresno and in Stockton, with experienced service technicians ready to handle even the most difficult of repairs. Central Valley Trailer Repair is an authorized Great Dane sales, parts, and service center, and you can always find a huge inventory of new and used semi-trailers for sale too. Dry freight, refrigerated, flat flatbed, whatever you're looking for, CVTR has you covered. How about 24-hour emergency service? You bet. What can't CVTR help you with? That's a question I can't answer, so you'll have to ask them yourself at 1-800-877-8444. That's 1-800-877-8444. The website, that's simple, cvtr.com. For Central Valley Trailer Repair, and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special D-Day anniversary edition of the program. We'll get back to Paratrooper Tom Rice's memories in a moment. But first, some audio that has survived nearly 8 decades. Perhaps you've heard before the message that General Dwight D. Eisenhower recorded for the troops just before they launched their assault on occupied Europe, June 6, 1944. A short excerpt from that speech is now etched in stone on one of the newest memorials in Washington, D.C. I had a chance to visit this past week, right behind a statue depicting the scene in which he uttered these sentiments. The Dwight D. Eisenhower Memorial bears the words, "The tide has turned. The free men of the world are marching together to victory." This memorial is definitely worth a visit the next time you're in our nation's capital. But here's how it sounded in Eisenhower's voice 78 years ago.
Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you. In company with our brave allies and brothers in arms on other fronts, you will bring about the destruction of the German war machine, the elimination of Nazi tyranny over the oppressed peoples of Europe, and security for ourselves in a free world. Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened. He will fight savagely. But this is the year 1944. Much has happened since the Nazi triumphs of 1940-41. The United Nations have inflicted upon the Germans great defeats in open battle, man to man. Our air offensive has seriously reduced their strength in the air and their capacity to wage war on the ground. Our home fronts have given us an overwhelming superiority in weapons and munitions of war and placed at our disposal great reserves of trained fighting men. The tide has turned. The free men of the world are marching together to victory. I have full confidence in your courage, devotion to duty, and skill in battle. We will accept nothing less than full victory. Good luck, and let us all beseech the blessing of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking.
So many of those men who took up that noble undertaking 78 years ago gave their very lives in the process. And now, so few of the survivors remain. We're going to get back to our 100-year-old paratrooper story in a moment. But first, a clip that never gets old for me. The Friends of the National World War II Memorial are still raising money to make President Franklin D. Roosevelt's D-Day words a permanent part of that hallowed ground in Washington. Did you know, by the way, that soil from American cemeteries abroad, including Normandy, was brought to Washington for the groundbreaking on that memorial 2 decades ago? Well, here's FDR speaking to the nation June 6, 1944.
My fellow Americans, last night when I spoke with you about the fall of Rome, I knew at that moment that troops of the United States and our allies were crossing the channel in another and greater operation. It has come to pass with success thus far. And so, in this poignant hour, I ask you to join with me in prayer. Almighty God, our sons, pride of our nation, this day have set upon a mighty endeavor, a struggle to preserve our republic, our religion, and our civilization, and to set free a suffering humanity. Lead them straight and true. Give strength to their arms, stoutness to their hearts, steadfastness in their faith. They will need thy blessings. Their road will be long and hard. For the enemy is strong. He may hurl back our forces. Success may not come with rushing speed, but we shall return again and again And we know that by thy grace and by the righteousness of our cause, our sons will triumph. They will be sore tried by night and by day, without rest, until the victory is won. The darkness will be rent by noise and flame. Men's souls will be shaken with the violences of war. For these men are lately drawn from the ways of peace. They fight not for the lust of conquest. They fight to end conquest. They fight to liberate. They yearn but for the end of battle, for their return to the haven of home. Some will never return. Embrace these, Father, and receive them, thy heroic servants, into thy kingdom. And for us at home, fathers, mothers, children, wives, sisters, and brothers of brave men overseas, whose thoughts and prayers are ever with them, help us, Almighty God, to rededicate ourselves in renewed faith in thee in this hour of great sacrifice. Many people have urged that I call the nation into a single day of special prayer. But because the road is long and the desire is great, I ask that our people devote themselves in a continuance of prayer. And, O Lord, give us faith. Give us faith in thee, faith in our sons, faith in each other, faith in our united crusade. Let not the keenness of our spirit ever be dulled. Let not the impacts of temporary events, of temporal matters of but fleeting moment, let not these deter us in our unconquerable purpose. With thy blessing, we shall prevail over the unholy forces of our enemy. Help us to conquer the apostles of greed and racial arrogances. Lead us to the saving of our country, and with our sister nations into a world unity that will spell a sure peace, a peace invulnerable to the schemings of unworthy men, and a peace that will let all men live in freedom, reaping the just rewards of their honest toil. Thy will be done, Almighty God. Amen.
Amen indeed. President Franklin D. Roosevelt, June 6, 1944. And one of those young men he was praying for, paratrooper Tom Rice, is back in Normandy this week at age 100 with the Best Defense Foundation.
We were in the most exclusive fraternity that occupies space on the face of the earth. That is a foot soldier and the airborne on patrol in enemy territory. That is a fraternity. Mm-hmm. There's not many guys in that.
No, and there were a lot that didn't get to come home.
Yeah, yeah.
And you were wounded in the first week of the Battle of the Bulge. It went on for a while after that. Is there a chance that being wounded when you did saved your life? I don't mean to minimize what you went through or the suffering that you experienced.
Yeah, who knows? That's just projection, and it may be a good possibility.
Because there are a lot of 101st Airborne guys who kept going after that. And who died.
They went on down to Alsace-Lorraine and did patrols into Hurtigan Forest, and they did a lot of things there.
And you have a very unique way of honoring the guys that you served with, and especially those who didn't come home. Tell me how you got the idea to jump out of an airplane every June 6th.
Risk taker again.
Yeah.
Full of energy. I had 51 years of long-distance running. There's got to be something else out there I can do.
Yeah.
You see? I had 44 years of high school and junior college teaching.
What'd you teach?
I taught U.S. government and U.S. history. And I never told anybody in the class about my activity in the 101st.
Wow.
Except once in page 476, chapter 24 in the history textbook. There was a picture of a lieutenant with, and I'm sure you've seen it, it's made a postage stamp out of it, with a piece of cardboard that's number 23 written on it, and a lot of guys around him, all of the guys trying to get eager to get into the conversation with General Eisenhower.
The picture in the textbook gave you the platform to share a little bit with your class.
Yeah, that's the only time. Mm-hmm. And we only spent just a short period of time on it, and only in one class. The idea is to honor those guys as best I can, and that's the only way I can do it. For what they did, those that were captured, killed, wounded, whatever. Part of the idea is to draw as much attention publicity-wise, although I didn't think of that at the moment, but that's what's happened. I pegged my livelihood to 101.
Okay.
101 airborne.
You want to go like a screaming eagle,
yeah,
huh?
Yeah, well, yeah. The guys have got a formula where they're going to use an old World War II helmet, and in it is going to be some kind of a liquor concoction that's going to knock you off your feet if you stand on a ladder 6 feet tall. And the last guy in the regiment who is still alive is going to have to drink that concoction and jump off of that 6 foot ladder. I'm not looking to that one, but
I think you might have a good shot of drinking out of that helmet.
Oh, I don't want to do that. I don't. I'm not. I don't drink.
Uh huh.
I never drunk. I never smoked. Whatever. Maybe that's why I'm that old.
I think that's why you're that young. Yeah. Well, one thing I want to make sure I say is thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us your story, and thank you for keeping the memory of your fellow airborne troops and World War II veterans in general in the consciousness, in mind. What would you say you're most proud of and most thankful for?
The support that the society has given me, the protection. You grow up in this city, this is a paradise to grow up in. The opportunities placed before me on so many different occasions. My gravesite is already sitting in Fort Rosecrans. I know where it is.
You know what kind of view you're going to have.
Yeah,
huh?
Number 325 in Columbarium 3A. So a democracy allows for all freedom of expression, etc. I got fed up with teaching about the activities of human beings as congressmen and all their corruptibility. So I began to move toward the theoretical in constitution building. And so I recall to these kids all of their gifts that they have been given in the Bill of Rights, freedom of speech, press, assembly, petition. So you can understand this, Joe. You've got hands. You can choose any occupation you want as long as it's legal. And so you've got feet. You can move around this country anytime you want. There's no borderline police stopping you going into Arizona. I appointed ideas about each one of those things that, so they could really understand what they're getting into and what opportunities are placed before them.
Well, and it hit me that you spent all those decades teaching these impressionable young minds about the Bill of Rights and about all the freedoms that they enjoy in this country. And they never knew how big a price you paid personally to secure those freedoms.
Yeah. And we came together in Washington, D.C., and we were going to go to the Battle of the Bulge, the places that the Germans had occupied. And we yo-yoed out of Luxembourg every day in a different direction. France, Germany, Holland, Luxembourg, and Belgium, all of those countries we yo-yoed out all around the Battle of the Bulge area. We went into Bastogne, and I noticed right on the right side there is the same old cemetery that I saw in 1944. Mm. Now it's covered with snow, and it looks really eerie. They threatened to kill me in Bastogne in 1944. Now what's going to happen in 2014? They damn near killed me again, because I came down with pneumonia later. Anyway, all the people in the city came in. They had pictures for us to sign. They wanted to talk to us. We marched up the hill, the Bastogne, to McAuliffe Square, where there's a big tank with a big shell hole in it. And so here we are, thousands and thousands of people just around that square.
Mm-hmm.
We're waiting for the King and Queen of Belgium. They came through with an entourage of military officers, so many stars that you couldn't count them. It looks like you're looking into the heavens.
Mm-hmm.
We're all in our red jackets. I told these guys, let's not call them red jackets. Let's call them the red badge of courage.
Mm.
They like that.
Well, it's fitting.
Yeah. The King and Queen came by, shaking hands with all of us red jacketed guys. I took her hand and I kissed it.
You kissed the Queen of Belgium's hand.
Yeah. I didn't know whether that was protocol or not, but she got her hand kissed. That was it. That's too bad.
And I'm sure you saw that what you did is not forgotten there.
Oh, yeah.
That they can't imagine their lives without the sacrifice that you guys made. That had to be pretty emotional for you.
Yeah, oh yeah, it was.
As it is again this week in what might be Tom Rice's final trip back to Normandy. I certainly hope it isn't. I'd love to see him go back and jump out of a plane again next year at age 101. He served in the 101st Airborne. He's done that so many times the last decade. Kudos again to our friend Donnie Edwards and his all-volunteer team at the Best Defense Foundation for taking Tom and 29 other veterans back to Normandy for the 78th anniversary. I encourage you to follow their experience online and chalk it up as another reminder of that truth we try to keep in the forefront every week on Hometown Heroes. Freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.